Thank you, Mr. Henderson. And Amanda, we'll see what we can do with him after you go back to St. Louis. Famous comedian in years past, Art Linkletter, used to say, "The trouble with parents is by the time you get them, they're so old it's hard to do anything with them." He had a point. Art Linkletter, the wisdom. Art Linkletter was born in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, so it's a little Canadian prairie wisdom for you, I guess. Well, this last week has been sobering on the world scene, to say the least. Week in a little bit. You know, following hard on the heels of the shocking result of the Brexit vote in the United Kingdom, we've barely had time to digest how that will change our wider world. And yet other events roll on in our nation too. The tragic deaths of two black men at the hands of white police officers, much of that graphically captured on cell phone video, has sent shockwaves throughout the country. Two other police officers have been assaulted in the last couple of days, one in St. Louis, one in Georgia. In some cases, just routine traffic stops. And it's hard to understand the mindset that fuels some of these things. But then, of course, the most troubling of all, disturbing, the news of the attack by a sniper, apparently a lone sniper, it was thought at first others, on police officers in Dallas who were monitoring a protest march, which further horrified us all. From some of the material I've read or understood, The marchers were actually, some of them, pausing to have their pictures taken with the police. Things were going reasonably well, even though it was in protest at some of these other earlier shootings. The president called this attack a vicious, calculated, and despicable attack on law enforcement. And whatever our politics, we could surely agree with that statement. And we, in God's church, which should be apolitical, but we can understand and recognize evil when we see it. And in ways that people in this world cannot, brethren, I hope we can assign properly evil to its source and where it comes from, no matter where it rears its ugly head. In the light of the times we live in, I did read something that was indicative, again, of those times. The president ordered that flags at all government buildings be lowered to half staff through Tuesday evening in light of the Dallas shootings. He has ordered the lowering of flags at federal institutions 67 times during his 7.5 years in office, the most of any president in U.S. history. That tells us something about the age in which we live. A total of 162 days, that's about 6% of the entire time that he has been in office. Of course, many of those times were for natural deaths of prominent individuals, such as almost 5 months ago at the death, for example, of a Supreme Court Justice, Antonin Scalia. But still, it's a dubious record for any president to leave office having had flags lowered to half-mast more than any previous president in our history. And of course, you just have to wonder, what would the record of succeeding presidents be? Will things get better? I think most of us would say we don't see that happening. They say records are made to be broken. That would be a tragic one to be broken and set something else. I was reminded of two recent communications from our headquarters office in Allen, Texas, both received this week. The first was the monthly member letter written by Church President Jim Franks, and I'd like to read a portion of his letter. Of course, he had in mind, as he says, his most recent trip with his wife Sharon and Dave Baker, our regional director for Asian areas. Excuse me. He says, "It's almost impossible for me to write a letter." This was, of course, written before the Dallas shootings. "Or give a sermon these days without referencing my recent trip to Asia. While Dave Baker, Sharon, and I traveled to the Philippines, Singapore, and Sri Lanka, we spent most of our trip in India, which to me is one of the most fascinating countries in the world. In preparation for this trip, I read the book Freedom at Midnight by Dominique Lapierre and Larry Collins, originally published in 1975, but updated in 2012. The authors thoroughly researched their subject, spending more than 5 years interviewing those who were directly involved in the independence movement in India, culminating in the creation of the countries of India and Pakistan at the stroke of midnight at the beginning of August 15, 1947. We should know, I think, from our history that there was just one country there as a British colonial possession before that. The map looks very different now. It was often just referred to as the subcontinent, and it took in what is now India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, because initially there were two Pakistans. You may recall from your history lessons, there was West Pakistan, which is now Pakistan, and there was East Pakistan, which is now Bangladesh. One of the most graphic chapters in the book is titled, "Our People Have Gone Mad." It describes the violence that took place in India and Pakistan after independence was granted. I won't attempt to describe how violent it was in this short letter, but trust me, the description of the murder of children was so graphic that it made me gasp when I read it. 1 million people were murdered in the months after independence in India. The worst nightmare of the British pulling out of India came true. Even the soul of India, Mohandas Gandhi, who was sometimes referred to as the Mahatma, a title, could not stop the bloodshed. The book describes blood flowing in the open sewers in the cities of Lahore and Calcutta and dead bodies filling the waterways around these two cities. It was a ruthless time, described by the leaders of the independence movement, Gandhi, Nehru, and Jinnah. That would be Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who was the first governor general of Pakistan and often considered the founder of Pakistan. So you had Muslim and Hindu leaders. These men referred to it as the time when our people went mad. Perhaps that is as good a place as any to launch into the topic for today. We could ask, is this the way prophetic events begin to play out? Does it come down to a time when people have gone mad? And what does it mean for us? What are we supposed to do? Where do we look? What are we looking for? Let me go on, and as I go on, let me read an email sent by Doug Horchak to the ministry yesterday. Most of you will know that Mr. Horchak is the operations manager for ministerial services for the church, so he oversees the ministry. And many of you may have seen this post because it later appeared on Facebook, the Kagwa Facebook page. He says, "Hello to all of you. The world we live in continues to show signs of desperation as it goes down an ever-darkening path. The tragic sniper shootings of law enforcement officers on the streets of Dallas, Texas last night," this was written Friday, "illustrate the deteriorating environment in our country and, for that matter, around the world. The event also underscores the desperate need of mankind to have the spiritual understanding that we as God's people are so very blessed to have. Last night, as my wife and I were watching national news prior to turning in for the evening, we witnessed the events live as police officers who were maintaining the public peace during demonstrations were gunned down from sniper fire in our own area of Dallas, no less. It is bad enough that racial and other tensions have increased the divide of many in our country. However, when the anger and frustration devolves into anarchistic actions such as this, it makes one feel that authorities are slowly losing grip on order and justice in our cities and communities. While driving into the office this morning, I listened as the Dallas mayor and chief of police updated the press and the public on the tragic events of last night and the ongoing investigation. In a change from normal protocol, toward the end of their update, both men admitted that they were people of faith, and they asked the press and the public to pray for the families of the victims and for the city. They mentioned a public prayer event that will take place at 12 noon at a downtown location where local religious leaders will convene. Their words seemed sincere. There is no doubt that these two men and countless others are looking for a source of solace and encouragement when such senseless events take place. They're also looking for answers to the broader concerns of division, confusion, and chaos that seem to be increasing in the fabric of our peoples and our country. As God's people, we have the answers. The brethren we serve do understand that the world we live in will be replaced by the government and family of God at Jesus Christ's return. Of recent weeks, I have thought much about the reason Christ began his instruction on how to pray with the words, 'Your kingdom come, your will be done.' Clearly, God desires his people to have a consistent, daily focus on the need for Jesus Christ's return and to have a deepening desire for the suffering, chaos, and tragedies of this world to come to an end. Only when we have a personal and emotional feel for the suffering, death, and tears of so many in this world can we pray, "Your kingdom come," with the kind of concern and sincerity that our Father no doubt desires from us. May God speed the day of His direct intervention in this world, and may we all be found doing His work and serving His people, as we know all of you do each and every day. Again, remember, this is written to the ministry. Those of us at the office pray that all of you and the congregations and brethren you serve have a wonderful and meaningful Sabbath day. Clearly, these events are driven by factors that many people around us just don't see or understand. Mr. Horchak put it well in his letter when he said, "As God's people, we have the answers. The brethren we serve do understand that the world we live in will be replaced by the government and family of God at Christ's return." That's an option that most people can't really grasp. I was reading an editorial in this morning's Plain Dealer, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, by a gentleman who is very perceptive of the events going on in our world. And he talked about the need. He echoed the words of the Dallas police chief to ask for unity and understanding and support. And he talked about how we need those things. We must have that. He said, otherwise, we are headed for more deepening troubles. And he went on to say, to close it, something about our prayers are reaching an end. And it was an interesting statement. It was as if, you know, are we running out of prayers or something like that. It's a recognition that we have to do something as people. But the trouble is, human beings have demonstrated they don't know what to do. And they don't know how to approach it. And they don't know how to end the problems. Brethren, as we've said so many times, the issue really boils down to this. Because God gave us what the Bible calls a spirit in man, or a human spirit, we can engender spiritually based problems for ourselves, dealing with human relationships. But because we don't have God's spirit, and when I say we, I mean the human race as a whole. You and I ought to and must. But because the human race doesn't have access to God's spirit, because it's been cut off since the Garden of Eden, with the exception of a rare few that God will call, there are no readily accessible spiritual answers to spiritual problems. There are only physical answers to spiritual problems, and that's never going to work. It's a square peg in a round hole. It simply cannot be brought about. I hope you and I understand that. I want to ask all of you to really think about what Mr. Horchak said. You know, in poring over some of the reaction among a wide spectrum of people that we know to be associated with the Church of God, primarily Kagwa, but others too, my wife and I have noted a theme. She's the one who scans through and gathers information from Facebook for me. If you're looking for me on Facebook, I'm afraid I'm not even a lurker. I'm not even there. I'm hiding behind her, so you have to go through her. But she keeps me updated on things. That's the way we work together. I know my own tendencies, and if I were on it, I would spend far too much time on it, which I suppose is a danger for anyone anyway. But the reaction that we saw was a kind of shock, even among God's people, and this is what's puzzling, and almost a plaintive question of what is happening. Reread Mr. Horchak's first paragraph. "The world we live in continues to show signs of desperation as it goes down an ever-darkening path. The tragic sniper shootings of law enforcement officers on the streets of Dallas last night illustrate the deteriorating environment in our country, and for that matter, around the world. The event also underscores the desperate need of mankind to have the spiritual understanding that we as God's people are so very blessed to have." What is happening? He put his finger on it. Turn, if you would, to Matthew chapter 24. This ought to be a familiar chapter for every one of us. It's one of three that deal with what we call the Olivet Prophecies. The other two, of course, being Mark 13 and Luke 21. Matthew 24, we'll pick it up in verse 3. Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ.'" Not claiming that they individually are Christ. There are, you know, we've got a few nutcases have done that. But that's not what he's talking about. He will say, people will say, they will point to him and they will say, "Jesus is the Messiah." Well, that's right. But then the Jesus they picture and describe, it doesn't resemble the one from the pages of the book at all. Not even in appearance. The Jesus of the Bible looked so much like the average Jew of his time that more than once he managed to evade pursuit by simply slipping through a crowd. The common portrayal of Jesus this day. And remember, he grew up as a carpenter and stonemason for the first 30 years of his life. Do you really think he looked kind of frail and effeminate? And that doesn't describe a carpenter or stonemason. He looked like a stocky, probably somewhat by our definition, short, short-haired, which was common in the day. All you have to do is study a little bit of history of the Roman Empire time and the Jews who lived in it. That's what he looked like. There was nothing, the book of Isaiah says, there's nothing, no beauty that we should desire him. He wasn't strikingly handsome. He didn't have movie star good looks. He didn't pose for selfies with people on the road, you know. That wasn't like Jesus at all. He says, "Take heed that no one will deceive you. Many will come in my name saying, 'I'm the Christ,' and they will deceive many," even claiming Jesus is the Messiah. They create deception. "And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilence, earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows." Think about those words. Read every word and let each one sink in. Do we hear our Savior speaking to us? Notice a couple or three key phrases in verse 4. "Take heed that no one deceives you." That's a warning. Jesus Christ did not issue that warning lightly. He was serious. And he went on to explain that deception would come in large part religiously through those who taught that Jesus was the Messiah. That's not enough. That's the place to begin, but it's not enough. Notice verse 6. "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars," or we might say horrific crimes and awful things. "See that you are not troubled." Who's he talking to? He's talking to his disciples. Brethren, that includes you and me, because remember in his final prayer in John 17, he said, "I don't pray for these alone," meaning the disciples at the time that surrounded him, "but for all those who shall believe on me through their word." That's you and me too. So he's talking to us, and he says, when you hear of these troubling events, don't be troubled. It puzzles me when I see sometimes God's people reacting as if something is amiss, as if something is unexpected somehow. Brethren, we must not think that the systems in place in this world have the answers to mankind's problems. The whole focus of the gospel message is that the answer must come from above. How does the sample prayer begin? "Thy kingdom come." I hope we're praying that with fervency. Looking around and saying, "Lord, it's true." Mankind cannot solve his problems. There are well-intentioned people, and we can give them high marks for their good intentions. It's far better to have good intentions and try than to be a massive part of the problem and going around shooting police officers. But despite the best of intentions, mankind cannot solve his problems. We should not be troubled when we see those things happening as if it's something out of place. Verse 8 says, all these are the beginning of sorrows. Jesus said, folks, that's just where it starts. Why do you act as if something unusual is taking place? Now, it's possible always for us to get lulled into a false sense of security. So now ask the question again. What is happening? Is it any clearer? Brethren, and especially let me address those under about the age of 50. Now, you thought I was going to say 20 or 25 or 30, didn't you? Let me raise it, because 50 is the new 30. So they tell us. So to anyone much under the age of 50, the relatively stable and predictable world that we have thought we lived in for roughly four decades or so shows signs of beginning to shift right before our eyes. Now, it may not shift drastically. It may be just a little. You know how when an earthquake happens, you can't really tell when there's just a little kind of a seismic shift and it's just a little rumble and then everything returns to normal. There was just a little bit of a break of the pressure and it relieved the pressure and nothing much else happens for maybe years more. That can happen in world events too. But sooner or later, the pressures of the tectonic plates shifting and grinding away underneath blows the whole thing wide open. And you never know when it will hit, and sometimes not where. That's a little bit like the world we live in. So for roughly the last 40 years or so, we've had a relatively stable and predictable world. I say relatively, obviously. There are huge and many exceptions. But the world order itself seemed predictable. Now, am I saying this, meaning that we're now in the home stretch, or some such thing, or it can't be more than 8 or 10 years till Christ comes back? That would be stupid. I will be blunt. That would be to ignore the lessons of our own history. It would also be to ignore Matthew 24 and verse 36, where Jesus Christ said, of that day and hour, no one knows. Not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. I hope we have all learned something. Although judging by posts that I see or hear from other groups sometimes, it appears some few have not. But brethren, we must not go there. I'm just saying that things will certainly bear watching. Certainly bear watching. Now, I mentioned the under 50 thing because those of us just a little bit older than that can remember a time when it appeared, to use the words from the book Mr. Franks read, it appeared people had gone mad. The time was called the 60s. And now those who lived through it are chuckling. And I don't mean the decade of your age, of the 60s. Yeah, I know people get weird when they hit their 60s, but, you know, that just happens. Mea culpa. I mean the decade between the 1950s and the 1970s, you know, that 60s. It was a time of huge changes societally in this country and in the Western world in general. And things changed in dramatic ways, in outlook, in approaches to life, in so many ways. Only, I guess you'd say, just the national scene. For example, the 60s, the stability of the 50s, you know, we talk about the Eisenhower era in history. essentially, most historians will say that ended on November the 22nd, 1963. And most of you will know what that means. Ironically, just a few blocks from where things happened Thursday night this time, at Dealey Plaza in Dallas, Texas, with the death of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And it seemed like things had gone mad. I remember walking home from school that day. I was in the sixth grade. I was almost 12 years old. My teacher had stopped the class and told us what had happened, and we were all in shock. We were in shock. The last time a president had been assassinated, presidents had died in office, but we didn't remember that either. Franklin Roosevelt, 1945, Warren Harding in the early 1920s. The last time a president had been assassinated was 1901, William McKinley from Ohio. We didn't remember that. Our parents didn't even remember that. My grandparents barely did. Well, they would have, but it was shocking. That was followed by several what used to be called long, hot summers. Those of you who lived through that time remember it, where we had race riots, racial tensions, and rioting, and looting, and deaths every summer through the mid-60s in this country, major cities across the country. Every year we wondered, what will happen this summer? Followed after that, you have the surely hate-motivated assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., who was only 39 when he died. Have we realized that? Thought about that? The man was never even 40 years of age. In Memphis, Tennessee, in April of 1968, shot and killed as he stood on a hotel balcony. Just 2 months after that, as he spoke in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, California, after winning the Democratic primary victory and his race for president, Robert Fitzgerald Kennedy was shot dead. Things seemed crazy. They'd gone nuts. I remember, as a teen of 16 years of age, sitting in a midweek Bible study on a Wednesday night in Kansas City, Missouri, in April of 1968, when the manager of the hall that the church rented for the studies came in and apologized to the minister for interrupting the study. He told the pastor, and we could all hear him, he just spoke from the back of the hall, that the mayor of Kansas City had just ordered a curfew, and that everyone needed to leave the hall immediately and make their way to their homes due to an outbreak of rioting in the city. As we exited the hall, we could hear gunshots just a few blocks away. All of the members did arrive safely home. On Sabbath, we were back in that same hall, downtown Kansas City, almost downtown. It was earlier in the day, of course, because the curfew didn't apply, I think, until like 7 or 8 at night. But we did have to make sure we left in time after the service concluded. We tended, like then, to have a little bit of snacks after services, and people tended to fellowship and stick around. But we had to make sure that we didn't violate the curfew order by making sure we left the area to get home before the curfew, to be sure we were home in time to meet the curfew. Was that a time when people went mad? Well, to those of us who lived through it, it certainly felt like it. On the world scene, in 1967, you had the Six-Day War in the Middle East. Vietnam was at its hottest, with protests in the streets about that, too. People were fleeing, draft-age young men were fleeing to Canada to evade the draft. A few years later, my wife and I, serving our first ministerial assignment in Winnipeg, Manitoba, came to the feast in the fall of 1974 in Wisconsin Dells. And somehow, I took a wrong turn. We were driving, and we had our young 6-month-old daughter, Pam, with us in the back in a car seat. And I took a wrong turn. It was probably that, you know, unpredictable old car we had, those 1968 Dodge Polaris with a slant six engine, you know. But got off on a little out-of-the-way border crossing, not the main one on the main highway. This was just after President Ford, who was in office by then, had put in place an amnesty for draft evaders. They could return to the United States without prosecution, but they still didn't want people sneaking back across the border. You had to go through it and apply in an orderly manner. So we got to the border, and of course at that time, I was just a tad younger than I am now, 1974. And I appeared to be military age, which I was. And they made me leave my wife and little girl in the car and come in the building. And I'm like, wait, while they sorted through all kinds of various lists they had to make sure I was not trying to sneak back into the country and evade whatever procedure I would have to go through. So about 2 days later, I was released. And no, it took a little while, but it wasn't that long. I don't really know what conversation my wife and our six-month-old daughter had in the car while I was gone, but yeah, probably praying, both of them. But I made it back. We continued on to the feast in Wisconsin Dells. Those were times, too. It seemed like things were crazy. It seemed, was it all a herald of the time of the end and the time when the work of the church would be ended? My dad was in the ministry for 24 years, from his ordination in 1968 until his death in April of 1992. And Dad was always very zealous about the way things would go, and he had a rather quick mind and a warped sense of humor, which, of course, I did not inherit. The warped sense of humor. Never mind. But he always had every year that ended, he had a little phrase, you know, it was 72 and we're through. You know, the work would be over. Then that didn't work out. So then it was 73 and we flee. Okay, that didn't work. So 74 and no more. 75, we're still alive. 76, we're in a fix. 77, we're not going to heaven. 78, it's getting late. I mean, he had something for every year. None of it worked out that way. And now my father has been in his grave awaiting the resurrection for almost a quarter of a century. So, where are we? Where are we? Was it the time of the end when the work of the church would be ended? Well, clearly not. Because now those events that I just described to you are almost 50 years in the past. Some of them are more than that. I am no longer that 16-year-old teenager. But the certainty of Christ's words has not changed. Read on in Matthew 24, back to verse 8. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended and will betray one another and will hate one another. Many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound. Is there a culture of lawlessness in our world? Well, look at the events of the last few days. The love of many will grow cold. There's even a culture of spiritual lawlessness in the churches by ignoring what God's law says. And pretending that it's an awful thing. That whole, you know, I'm sure glad to be out from the burden of that nasty old law. Law can't give you salvation. It was never its purpose. The law is to reveal the righteous standard of living. Of course it can't give you salvation. That's not what God designed it to do. You know, we have a joke about if the only tool you have in your toolbox is a hammer, you tend to perceive every problem as a nail. You know, there are different purposes for different things. It says, many will be offended, will betray one another, will hate one another. Many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. Lawlessness will abound. Love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. I've written a phrase in my margin here that says, go the distance. I used to run track as a young man in high school and college. Not particularly well, but I enjoyed it. It was kind of like banging your head against a brick wall. It felt wonderful when you stopped. But I ran distance, mile and 2 mile, cross country. He who endures to the end shall be saved. I knew the feeling back then. You go on an 8 mile training run and you say, boy, this is going to feel so good when I stop. This kingdom, or this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations. And then the end will come. Can you or I actually imagine this time? It's hard to do. It's hard to do. What's the most important aspect? Well, pick it up in verse 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his master made ruler over his household, to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and he begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he's not looking for him, and at an hour that he is not aware of. And he will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Do we think Jesus Christ meant these words? Every one of them. Every one of them. Something else Mr. Horchak said struck me. He said in his letter, clearly God desires his people to have a consistent daily focus on the need for Jesus Christ's return, and to have a deepening desire for the suffering, chaos, and tragedies of this world to come to an end. Only when we have a personal and emotional feel for the suffering, death, and tears of so many in this world can we pray, your kingdom come, with the kind of concern and sincerity that our Father no doubt desires from us. Can we pray those words? And can we mean them? In Ezekiel chapter 9, a passage of Scripture that echoes those words, or maybe Mr. Horchak's words echo this passage of Scripture, might be more accurate. Ezekiel 9, verse 1, it says, then he called out in my hearing with a loud voice, saying, let those who have charge over the city draw near, each with a deadly weapon in his hand. And suddenly 6 men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his battle axe in his hand. One man among them was clothed with linen and had a writer's inkhorn at his side. They went in and they stood beside the bronze altar. Now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub where it had been to the threshold of the temple. And he called to the man clothed with linen who had the writer's inkhorn at his side. And the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it. Does that strike a chord with us, brethren? These are people of God who are set apart for special recognition by God, and in some cases a special protection by God. Although even if he chooses not to give that, in his wisdom and for reasons of his own, it changes nothing. Do we sigh and cry for the abominations that are done in the midst? Do we cry out to God and say, how long, Eternal? Please, in your mercy, may your kingdom come. I look forward so much to that day when people can be taught the right way, when Satan will be bound. Do we mean? The meaning of the Day of Atonement grows larger every year. The binding and the restraint of Satan. How much does that day mean? I don't care if my stomach's rumbling a little bit here and there. To know what that day means is powerful. Powerful. We need it. This world needs it. Every one of these people on this planet, alive and those who have died in history, everyone is God's child. Even the ones so deceived by Satan that they are perpetrating horrendous things. Remember what it says in Peter? He's not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. That's the mind of God. Can we wrap our minds around it? We need to think about those things. Let's switch gears and our focus for the next part of the message. On June the 23rd of this year, as we all know now, the United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union, a move that shocked the experts and threw international markets into a real tizzy. These experts, primarily the elite of society in many cultures, especially in the UK, had predicted that the vote might be close, but they seemed confident that Britons would not risk the financial downturn that most predicted could occur. And in fact, most experts pretty much don't see any way out of it for the UK at this point. The experts were wrong about the outcome of the election, weren't they? I mean, if you watched financial markets, they were all kind of trending up a little bit, holding steady in the days leading up to the election, and then, whoa, madness. What happened? With a higher voter turnout than in any election in the UK since the 1992 general election, almost a quarter of a century ago, nearly 72% of all eligible voters went to the polls. When the dust had settled, voters across the United Kingdom, which officially is called the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, Great Britain being composed of England, Scotland, and Wales, voters across the UK had selected the leave option by 52% to 48%. Yeah, that adds to 100. I want to make sure. Within hours, the value of the pound sterling had plummeted from about $1.50 in U.S. funds to around $1.32. It has dropped further since then. If you're going to the feast in the Isle of Jersey, you're saying, whoa, this is working out well. Yesterday afternoon at about 3:30 Eastern Daylight Time, around 8:30 in what is called British Summer Hours, they don't call it daylight time, it's British Summer Hours, or 7:30 Greenwich Mean Time, well after the financial markets had closed in England, the pound stood at $1.29.5, between 13 and 14, closer to 14% below its pre-Brexit value. That's a pretty catastrophic drop. And that's really just the beginning. Nobody knows quite where it's going to go yet. For example, the sentiment was vastly different in different parts of the UK. Most areas within England and Wales voted to leave, although some had higher percentages than others. But the city of London, per se, the city of London residents voted overwhelmingly to remain. Just a smidgen under 60% wanted to stay in the EU. Nearly a margin of 3-2. More ominously, Scotland voted 62% to remain, 38% to leave. Sorry, yeah, that's right. Northern Ireland voted almost 56% to remain, 44% to leave. So now you've got a real problem. Now there's talk of yet another Scottish referendum. Remember, just 2 years ago, the Scots voted on whether to stay a part of the United Kingdom. And it was, 53%? I don't remember the details now. It wasn't terribly close. They were all saying razor thin, too close to call. And in the end, it was, while not overwhelming, as these folks go, it was a comfortable margin to stay in the UK. But now what do? They voted 62% to remain in the EU, but their votes were drowned by the greater population of England and Wales combined. Well, now there's talk in some areas in Scotland of let's do it again. Let's vote again, not on whether the UK stays in the EU, pardon all the letters, but whether Scotland stays in the United Kingdom. Even when you travel now, if you take, let's say you take the train from England up to Scotland and you hit an ATM as soon as you get into Edinburgh Station, you'll get pounds sterling. It's still what we call the British pound, but it doesn't look like the money from England at all. All the faces are different, the designs of the bills are different. Now, they're still good if you take them to Northern Ireland or England or Wales, but you'll kind of get looks in stores if you hand an English merchant a Scottish pound, or, well, Scottish five-pound note. There's nothing. There are no bills below a five-pound note. Well, now they're talking, should we vote to go? Northern Ireland is filled these days with talk of a referendum there to whether to join the nation of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, to the south. That is in the EU. Ireland, in fact, the Irish have used the euro for years. They don't use the British pound. The Republic of Ireland uses the euro. Northern Ireland uses the British pound. Now, to make matters more complicated for us as Americans, the six counties that form the independent country of Northern Ireland. Remember, the UK is the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. There are six counties in and around Belfast that form the country of Northern Ireland. But often you'll hear a term used, Ulster. Many of you have probably heard that term. Ulster, to further puzzle us, is composed of nine counties. The six that form Northern Ireland and then three others, County Cavan, County Donegal, and County Monaghan, that are part of the Republic of Ireland, but together they all form Ulster, which is incredibly confusing. Of course, if you're Irish, you probably had it figured out a long time ago. Daft Yankees, what do they know? But it just matches a very ancient division of the island into five parts. Are you confused? So are they. What will they do? Will they stay or will they go? Will they reunite as one Ireland? Think of all the bloodshed over the years between the Catholics and Protestants on the island. Primarily Protestant Northern Ireland, primarily Catholic Republic of Ireland, divided Ulster, which had six counties. You know, never mind. Let's not go into all that again. Who knows? Makes you scratch your head, doesn't it? That's easier for some of us than others. Others have a hard time getting through the hair mat to get to the head. Some of us have a very easy job of scratching our heads. And then, of course, there are the political ramifications. Within hours of the vote being known, the vote result, Prime Minister David Cameron announced that he would step down as the leader of the Conservative Party, which is the party currently in power in the parliamentary style of democracy that the UK has. Most democracies in the world, we should know, are not the republic form like we have. They are parliamentary form like Britain, where the party in power in the legislature, the lower house, usually the one that has the most power and influence, House of Commons in Britain, that party has a leader, and the leader of their party is a member of the legislature, but he's also the prime minister, he or she. Most countries are like that if they're democratic. That means that Mr. Cameron will not be the prime minister, because if he resigns as prime minister, then his party needs a new leader. When will that happen? Well, he stated that he campaigned so strongly to remain in the EU that he cannot realistically lead the Brexit, British exit. So another leader for the Conservative Party has to be elected. The process is well underway. They're down to two. The Tory caucus, that means the Conservatives who are members of Parliament, there are 330 of them, have narrowed the choice down to two, both women. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, is the favorite. There is no comparable office here to Home Secretary. It's a high-level position in the British cabinet. The Home Secretary oversees internal affairs, citizenship issues for all of UK, internal affairs for England, security in England, Wales, MI5, the security agency, reports to the Home Secretary. There is no comparable U.S. cabinet post. But she's the favorite. She was in favor of staying with the EU, but she pretty much stayed out of the debate, just kind of sat on the sidelines. So she still has credibility to lead the party, because she says Brexit means Brexit. The nation said go, If I am prime minister, we will work through it. Her opponent is Andrea Leadsom, a member of parliament. She campaigned actively to leave. She's never served in the cabinet, which is usually thought to be a prerequisite to becoming the prime minister and leader of your party. So either way, Britain will have its second woman prime minister. Margaret Thatcher, of course, was the first, who served from 1979 to 1990, known as the Iron Lady, as you probably recall. The selection will take place with all members of the Conservative Party voting, not just the ones who are in Parliament, on September the 9th, just exactly 2 months from today. What about wider European concerns? Well, the other nations in Europe don't want to see the whole dream of a Europe that is united not by war and conquest of a tyrant, but by political and economic unity. That was the idea. It's a laudable goal. We tend to see it in terms of biblical prophecy and say, beast power, final resurrection of the Roman Empire, which it is prophetically, but we're failing to see that it's another human attempt to govern ourselves. How will this attempt turn out? That's where we turn to Bible prophecy, and we know. But please don't be hard on people who don't have that to look at and say, they say European unity is a wonderful dream. It is. Guess what? I'm in favor of European unity too, under the reign of Jesus Christ. Aren't you? We're in favor of unity of all peoples and nations. So that dream is threatening now to come unraveled. There are 28 nations currently in the European Union. Some of the other 27 are now suggesting they treat the UK pretty harshly, so that no other nation gets the idea that it's just easy to leave and the whole thing blows up and it's all gone. And in their minds, they're left unprotected against the future. And the history of Europe is not promising when nations separate and go their own ways and start picking at each other. It's a history of bloodshed that goes back centuries. The whole scheme, the whole dream of a united Europe would have to be reworked somehow. Well, that may happen. There are some weak links, of course, notably of the major nations, Italy at present. One of Italy's largest banks, Banca Monte dei Paschi di Siena, that may be terrible Italian, my apologies to anyone here who speaks Italian, was recently revealed in an article in the Wall Street Journal to have about 17% of all of its loans. That's one out of six loans, it says, the Wall Street Journal says, they've gone sour. Now, I'm not sure what the Wall Street Journal means when it says a loan has gone sour, but I don't like the sound of it. And that's one of the largest banks in Italy. What happens if Italy decides to opt out, or Italy has more economic troubles? There's already tension among the members of the EU over the more prosperous and successful ones about the ones that they're having to drag along. They call them the pigs. Have you heard that expression? It stands for Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Greece, P-I-I-G. Those are the four weak links they view at this point. So now what? Now what? Where will it all lead? Well, of course, for those of us who have followed this path of life for many years, we believed that at some point, in some fashion, it was virtually a foregone conclusion that at least England, and probably Wales too, as it now appears, would end up leaving the European Union. We're not sure what will happen with Northern Ireland or Scotland. To be fair, we don't know. Why? Why do we feel that way? Because of what we believe and understand Bible prophecy to reveal. It starts with Genesis, Genesis 48. Genesis 48 and verse 14, just before the death of Jacob, who you recall was renamed Israel, meaning one who prevails with God rather than one who supplants or takes what is unright, takes one that is not rightfully his, takes something away. So Israel stretched out his right hand, and he laid it on Ephraim's head. And he laid, who was the younger, and he laid his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph, and he said, God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, the Angelos, that's capitalized. When you see that, it is almost certainly a reference every time in the Old Testament to the one who became Jesus Christ. You realize, remember, Jacob wrestled with a messenger from God, the Angelos. Bless the lads. Let my name be named upon them. Interesting. In terms of prophetic fulfillment, when you read just in very general terms, Israel, it can be understood to mean the two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, in primary fulfillment. And the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. Remember, Ephraim was the younger of the two boys. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. It was a right hand was a gesture of showing preference. Sorry, southpaws out there. And Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. But his father refused, and he said, I know, my son, I know. He also, meaning Manasseh the older, shall become a great people. He also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. Interesting description, isn't it? Who historically has had a wider influence in the world over the last 200 to 300 years? United States or British Empire? Don't just think this in the last 100 years or so. Think 200 or 300 years. Well, the British Empire. There was a time when it was said that the sun never set on the British Empire. A multitude of nations. How about supplying the word commonwealth instead of multitude? Does that fit? Can you see patterns in history? Chapter 49 and verse 22, when it describes Joseph. Remember now, Joseph was really given a double portion then, because his two sons were elevated to be as if they were the sons of Jacob or Israel. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. It's as if he goes on beyond his own boundaries. Does that describe the powers, particularly of the British Empire? The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father who will help you, by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breasts and the womb, the blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. Now, of course, that was true historically. The brothers had sold Joseph into Egypt and so on. But this is prophetic. Clearly, the prophecies for the future for Joseph are even distinct in a way from the rest of his brothers. Greater. We call it the birthright. It was being passed to the two sons jointly, with a slightly greater portion to Ephraim, the younger. Deuteronomy chapter 33 reiterates some things. Moses, of course, Deuteronomy means second law or a second telling or a reiteration. Maybe we don't think of the word iterate as being a word, but it is. When we reiterate, we say it again. We don't usually go around saying, well, I was iterating with so-and-so the other day. And Deuteronomy 33, verse 13, of Joseph he said, blessed of the Lord is his hand with the precious things of heaven, with the dew, the deep lying beneath, with the precious fruits of the sun, with the precious produce of the months, with the best things of the ancient mountains, with the precious things of the everlasting hills, with the precious things of the earth and its fullness, the favor of him who dwelt in the bush. Of course, the reference to the burning bush that Moses saw. Let the blessing come on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. His glory is like a firstborn bull, and his horns are like the horns of the wild ox. Together with them, he'll push the peoples to the ends of the earth. They are the 10,000s of Ephraim and the thousands of Manasseh. When you look at a reference of the furthest extent of the British Empire and the furthest extent of the powers of the United States, they controlled massive percentages of the world's resources, strategic possessions, and we're losing some of them bit by bit, but you know, you talk about the Panama Canal, the Suez Canal, the control of the Cape of Good Hope, so many things. You know, I cannot trace it completely through history. I can't. But I can look at the relatively recent history of the world of the last 200 years or a bit more, and I can see two sets of nations who are like brothers, and who, despite occasional squabbles with each other, like brothers, have developed along the same lines foretold back in Genesis and Deuteronomy. They comprise one great, powerful nation with tremendous influence that has often had a unique and special relationship with a kind of a brother nation that was really composed of a commonwealth of nations. You find countries like that in the last 200 years in human history? Well, I can. But I can also see their relative power and influence on the wane. I can see what seems to me to be a breaking of the pride of their power and influence, a retreat from a position of global preeminence. And it leads to some of the uneasiness and the unrest and the unpredictability in our world now. And since Jacob, whose name was Israel, said, "Let my name be named on the lads," I can expect to see further deterioration and even conquest and captivity because of certain prophecies. Because I read, for example, in Jeremiah 30, and I read these words. They were historical when they were written. They had a certain timely application back then. But they spoke about so much more and so much further into the future. In Jeremiah 30 and verse 9, it says, "For thus says the Eternal, we have heard a voice of trembling, of fear, and not of peace. Ask now and see whether a man is ever in labor with child. So why do I see every man with his hands on his loins like a woman in labor, and all faces turned pale? Alas, that day is great, so that none is like it. It is the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. For it shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord of hosts, that I will break his yoke from your neck." There will be a yoke on the necks of our peoples. That usually refers prophetically to captivity. "And I will burst your bonds. Foreigners will no more enslave them. But they shall serve the Eternal their God, and David their king, whom I will raise up for them." Pretty clear what the time frame is, isn't it? After the return of Jesus Christ and the resurrection of the saints, when David is king over a united Israel again. There is hope beyond, as we can see. But where does this all leave us? Brethren, we're all familiar with Luke 21:36. Let's take a look to be sure we remember what it says, but we're all familiar with it. I know that's one of the pet peeves of young people growing up in God's church when the minister says, "Well, you're all familiar with us in such a verse," and then you don't turn to it. And some of the young people are saying, "Well, I'm not familiar with it. You know, I just started paying attention last week. I mean, after all, I am 42 years old now." No. You know. All of us come to awareness as we grow up. I mean, I've told the story about me asking my parents when I was 8 years old why they were having trouble with the carpentry, with the door at the church hall in Philadelphia. And they said, "What do you mean?" Well, I said, "Mr. So-and-so read the verse that said I've this is the message to the church at Philadelphia. I've set before you an open door and no man can shut it. And I couldn't figure out why they couldn't close the door at the church. But at least, you know, I understood the meaning of the words. I just didn't understand their import. So we're turning to Luke 21:36. So don't give me grief about this. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. We focus on the watch part, but we sometimes divorce it from its context. Yeah, it is important to watch what's happening on the world scene. I've gone through a whole sermon today talking about what's happening around us and the impact and where will it lead, and keep an eye on things and pay attention and be current and conversant with what our world has. But what's the context? Verse 34, take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, so that that day come on you unexpectedly. He never tells us we'll know when it's going to come. He never says you'll be able to predict and say on thus and such a date, you know, the nations will go into captivity, the work will shut down, the church will flee to a place of safety, and 3.5 years later, to the dot, I will return, you got it figured out. Never says that. In fact, he says pretty much the opposite. But he does say, if you are in a spiritually strong condition, it will not catch you by surprise. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. That's the context. Stay close to God. When we watch world events, brethren, it should reinforce to us the truth of the predictions of the Bible, that God must send His Son, Jesus Christ, to this earth. He must, or our goose as a race is cooked. That's what we need to think about. Of course, we notice what's happening in our world, and we wonder where, and more appropriately, I guess, we always wonder when it will lead there. But what is truly most important of all? Is it to be like the children's story, like Chicken Little, running around shrieking, "The sky is falling! The sky is falling!" Or is it to confidently make predictions of specifics and dates? On July the 17th, 2018, California will slide into the ocean. A massive earthquake. That was ironic, sardonic, sarcastic. Please, don't anyone think I just made a prediction. That's what we should not be doing. Everybody knows it'll be in 2019, not 2018. No. Peace. Peace. We don't know those particulars. But when we see things happening, will we be grounded enough in the Word of God that we can say, that's fitting a pattern that I recognize? I can see how these things could lead that way. And if it takes a U-turn somewhere down the road and say, okay, didn't work out. Be like my dad, 72 and we're through, 73 and we flee, 74 and no more, and so on. Now he awaits the resurrection. As we watch, we are going around neither crying out in fear nor trying to predict just how things will work out. But we are observing and relating the current events we see to that general framework of biblical prophecy that we know from God's word will yet happen. And we realize the most important words of all in the Olivet prophecy are Jesus' words when he says, the faithful servant, the righteous person, the one who is paying attention, a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season. This is what we look for. That's who we want to be. That's a sound approach. And while you're at it, don't forget to look beyond today's awful headlines and puzzling events and try some of these on for size, like Isaiah chapter 2, where it says in the first few verses. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Eternal's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, we shall walk in his paths, for out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He'll judge between the nations and rebuke many peoples, and they'll beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. How about that? How about something like Isaiah chapter 6, where it talks about the picture of the millennial reign of Christ? How about Isaiah chapter 9, where it says in verse 6, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The government will be on his shoulder. His name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David, over his kingdom, to order and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward forever. The zeal of the Eternal Host will perform this. Actually, it's chapter 11 and verse 6 I was thinking of, about the wolf dwelling with the lamb and so on. How about Isaiah 25? Well, let's back up. Let's go to Isaiah 19. How about this one in light of modern events? He starts talking about Egypt. And then in verse 21, it says, Isaiah 19, verse 21, the Lord will be known in Egypt, and the Egyptians will know the Lord in that day, and they'll make sacrifice and offering, and they'll make a vow to the Lord and perform it. Egypt is a password in the Bible. It is a byword representing sin. But God says, not in that day. Not in that day. The Lord will strike Egypt. He'll strike and heal it. They will return to the Eternal. He'll be entreated by them and heal them. In that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. And the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians will serve with the Assyrians. In that day Israel will be one of three with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the land. And the Lord of hosts shall bless them all, saying, blessed is Egypt, my people, Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. What a day that'll be. Isaiah 25, you could read about that. Verses 6 and 7. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all people a feast of choice pieces, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of well-refined wines on the lees. He'll destroy on this mountain the surface of the covering cast over all peoples, that veil they can't penetrate, can't see through. The veil spread over all nations. He'll swallow up death forever, eventually, in his plan. How about those verses? How about the whole chapter of Isaiah 35, that beautiful picture of the lame leaping, the blind seeing, the deaf hearing? On and on and on it goes. Many years ago, I heard a minister in God's church say, folks, it's important to watch world events, but don't get hung up on them. Don't think you've got to be able to identify the 10 nations in the last resurrection of the Roman Empire. Don't go around saying, I think he'll be the beast power. That'll be the false prophet. He said, God is far more interested in what he plans to do in prophecy than he is in what Satan plans to do. I thought that was an excellent point. What are we focused on, brethren? What I'm saying is, when will all these things happen? What happens when things start to come apart in our world? Well, they have at times seemed to come apart before. And sometimes it seems to settle down for a while. At some point, these prophecies will begin to be fulfilled. I don't know when. You've heard my sermons before whenever I say, I'm going to tell you when this will all happen. Because I always say the same thing. I don't know. That's my answer. But since Jesus himself told us that was the deal in Matthew 24, I'm not really worried about that aspect of things. No man knows the day or the hour. I'll let Mr. Franks and Mr. Horchak have a last word today. From Mr. Frank's member letter, In spite of the very different cultures and challenges in each country where we visited, there is a common spirit and culture among God's people. We are citizens of God's kingdom first, and that binds us together even more than our country of origin. We returned home from this trip to Asia exhausted physically and emotionally, but recharged spiritually. We will never forget the people we met, the things we saw, the lessons we learned. Please pray for your brothers and sisters in Asia as they face life's challenges in a very different world from where most of us live. Mr. Horchak's email to the ministry, I already read it a time or two. May God speed the day of his direct intervention in this world, and may we all be found doing his work and serving his people. Those are things to keep in mind, brethren, as we look at an unpredictable world around us and ask, is prophecy the time when people go mad? Maybe so in the short term, but in the long term, prophecy is the time when God sends his Son to return and when all peoples have a chance to understand